Hi, my name is Steve.
Hi, my name is Rami.
And Rami, why don't you introduce yourself to our lovely guests?
Absolutely. My name is Rami Ismail. I am an independent game developer. I used to work at an independent game studio called Flambeer, which I co-founded with a fellow student back in the days. We were best known for games such as Super Crate Box, Luftrausers, Ridiculous Fishing, and Nuclear Throne. Besides that, in the games industry, I'm probably best known for my work on giving fair access to game development resources to developers around the world, traveling to developers everywhere and talking to them, teaching them and learning from them, and the development of free tools such as Preskin. Besides that, I'm Dutch-Egyptian, although I've not been much in either country for the past decade, traveling around the world most of the time. And that's kind of it, I guess. That's
me. I like how you listed off a laundry list of accolades, and you're like, what else have I done?
Right. It's that thing where the baseline of your level becomes a certain level where you're like, okay, I've done all these things. So what are actually like exciting new things that are happening?
And I mean, it will
gets a little.
Yeah, well, I mean, we'll definitely get into your baseline and why you're called the king of the indies in our circles. But I always like to start these things in the Inside the Actors Studio way of starting at the beginning. So why don't you tell us, you know, where things started for you? Where did you grow up?
I grew up partially in the Netherlands, partially in Egypt. My father is an Egyptian man and my mother is a Dutch woman. They met in the Netherlands and I was raised between those two countries. So for me growing up, I spoke Dutch, I spoke Arabic. I didn't speak English, which was a little complicated when we got our first computer. But somehow I found my way around that computer and through MS-DOS and eventually a program called QBasic. There was a tutorial file there called Gorillas, and I edited a line of code there to change it into my name. I had no idea what it would do, and I ran the game again. And then instead of saying Gorillas at the top, it said my name at the top. And the whole idea that you could change text to change a video game was mind-blowing to me. So I kind of chased that for the rest of my life.
Yep.
Like, that's where things happened. I must have been 6 for that. So I was very young.
Wow.
So I kind of chased that. And back in those days, you know, video games weren't like they are now. Like, video games were more of this like hacky tech product that sort of accidentally happened, I feel. So a lot of the files would just be plain text and a lot of the textures would just be BMPs or, you know, like files you could open in Paint and then modify. So I'd spend a lot of time like redrawing textures and like just typing stuff into text files and changing the mission description names in games and editing the speed at which certain vehicles moved. And the more I could hack a game, the more interesting the game was to me. And then a lot of games also came with level editors. So Age of Empires was big for me, and StarCraft. I think the Jazz Jack Rabbit had a level editor. I'm pretty sure you could like create levels for Quake and Unreal Tournament. So I was mostly just messing around with stuff. And I did that for a good like 10, 15 years, yeah. I think, until I was in a store one day. My mom was shopping and there was this computer store. And I went into the computer store and there was this old cardboard box, the last copy of something called Dark Basic. And I started with this program called QBasic. And I was like, oh, that must be like the programming thing, right? And I'd been learning a bit of programming through all the modding and all the... I was like, this could be fun. So I bought that and it was the last copy that they ever had and were ever going to sell. The guy at the checkout even remarked on it. He's like, we never sell this, and I don't think we'll ever sell it again. And I'm like, okay. I brought it home, and via that, I learned of a company called Starwraith 3D Games, which was doing space sims. And they had this forum where the developer was like openly talking with the people buying the game, and it was his game. He was making the game, and he was selling the game. And it kind of convinced me that you could be a game developer. Right.
Wow.
I never thought of it as a job. I thought of it as a hobby, like just a thing I did, because all the people that were making these games were like John or Chris or I'm Rami Ismail.
Right.
Like, that didn't sound like a thing I could do. And there weren't games companies in the Netherlands or anything. Guerrilla Games wasn't a known entity yet. So if I had looked carefully, I might have noticed that Jazz Jackrabbit was like also made by a Dutch person, but I hadn't noticed, right? So for me, it never felt like a career that I could do until I met the Star Raid 3D guy. And Sean kind of convinced me that this was a thing I could do. So I helped out a bit over there. And then eventually I learned that there were two schools in the Netherlands that taught game design. So I went to one of them and met my co-founder, then dropped out of the school, started Vlaambeer. And from there, things went really fast to the point where if you would ask me to summarize my life in this way, the last sentence would be, and we dropped out of school. Because everything after that is such a blur that it makes no sense to me.
I 100% can see that, and you're a whirlwind of a life. It's interesting having done several of these interviews that sort of come at things differently than, you know, you and I are used to giving lots of interviews. So trying to think of a different way to talk about these kind of things. It's interesting that so far, of all the interviews that we have pre-recorded, they all have the same commonality in it was somebody talking about how that when they were a child, they didn't think that you could earn a living doing what they do now. It's an amazing commonality that, like, these creative fields, we don't really teach in school that this could be a life choice for you.
Right. Yeah, I think one of the things that's interesting about creative media in particular is that it moves so fast that there is no way to teach people that this is going to be a job, because when I grew up, it wasn't a job, right? It was like an out of hand hobby for a lot of people. And there were some people making money with some shareware, but when I was born, EA was a few people, right? If it existed, I don't know, when was EA founded? But like, it was not big. It was not a big thing. This was not a corporate industry. Right. It was a few people making some video games and making a little bit of money. So you can't really teach us that this is going to be a job, just like, you know, Twitch streaming. You can't teach people that that's going to be a job, or being an influencer or being a game critic or any of those things. Like, just didn't exist. So what I tend to like about the people that are in these industries is that they're people that are okay with charting their own path. Right. And they enjoy charting their own path. They enjoy not necessarily knowing where things are going, and they're okay with things going in a cool direction for now. Right. And I think frequently another commonality is that even though there wasn't a job, they never got good at anything else. Right. It's very true for me. I'm a game developer. I've been doing this since I was a kid. And sure, I've trained to fly small airplanes, right? I can do that. And I'm an okay writer, and I can do lots of other things. But like, the thing that I'm good at is game development. And I wouldn't know what to do with my life if I wasn't doing this. So it's really strange how when you talk to people that are in this situation, very often that's sort of a common sentiment as well. It's like, no, I'm here because this makes sense, and because this job or this thing that I'm doing specifically speaks to my interests and my talents. And I think that's fun as well.
What do you think is the path that you would have taken had you not gone into game development?
So there's this evil version of me that would have definitely gone into politics, I think.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, because one thing, when I was a kid, there's this amazing story. I was always an annoying kid, right?
Okay.
And people on Twitter can probably like speak to that a little bit. But
we're not going to ask them, don't worry.
I was always a little bit of an annoying kid. And my kindergarten teacher realized that I wasn't necessarily being annoying. I was mostly just bored, right? Because I would get all the class material and I would read it, even at like age five, I would read it and be done with all the material in like a week, and then be bored for the rest of the year. And all the exercises we got weren't interesting, because I was a, what's the word in English? A gifted kid. I don't like the word, but okay. So the school and a bunch of people that were caring for me and about me, they decided to have me do a psychological evaluation, right? So I went to this group thing in the Netherlands, this socialized welfare thing where kids can get mental evaluations and stuff like that. And they put me in a group with a bunch of kids, And I had to go four times. My dad, being Egyptian, he has this little suitcase with important papers. And a few years ago, he opened the suitcase and he gave me a folder with stuff from my childhood.
Oh, wow.
And he's going like, this is all the stuff from when you're a kid. You're an adult now. It's yours.
Oh.
You know, do with it what you want. Uh-huh. And one of them was the evaluation report for that specific evaluation. Yeah. And it said, Rami staged a mutiny because he wanted the cookies that we give kids after the evaluation before they would participate, and convinced all the other kids to participate in the mutiny. And it basically, the recommendation was, like, Rami has an innate ability to position himself as a leader and to convince people of his beliefs, and it would need very careful guidance to make sure that that would turn into a constructive trait instead of a destructive
trait. So they thought you'd either run a country or a gang, and they weren't sure which one.
they're like, this is either going to end up the Godfather, or Rami's going to do something good in life.
Wow.
Yeah, it's really interesting to see how throughout my life, there's always been these people that have nudged me in a constructive direction with that. It's kind of wild. It's kind of strange to think back that if any of those people hadn't nudged me in that direction, I don't know where I would have ended up, right? I would like to answer that question with saying, like, I would love to have been a pilot instead, because I really love flying. But they convinced me that with the glasses, you can't become a pilot. And I think back then that might have been true. It's no longer true now.
But, right. Yeah.
It wasn't an option back then, or it felt like it wasn't an option back then. So I went, well, because the only other thing I would like to do and I'm good at is game development, so I'll study that.
I like that. So, you bring up the great bridge of mentors. You know, who are the right. great mentors to you in your life? And I don't mean, like, who taught you to code. Like, I mean, like, who do you actually consider a mentor that helped shape you into who you are today?
Right. So that kindergarten teacher is probably the most important person. The obvious answers are obviously the people I work with directly. Jan-Willem Nijman, my co-founder at Vlaambeer, was a huge influence on the way I think about creativity and business. But if you go back in life, my parents are obviously a huge influence on who I became today. My mom, being Dutch, she was always very much a person that supported me, whatever I wanted to do. The Netherlands is a relatively wealthy country. We have great social support networks. So people here kind of have an attitude of just do what you love, right? No matter how it works out, because the worst case scenario is it works out, right? And my dad came from Egypt, which is very different. If things don't work out there, you're in deep trouble. So my dad was always like, you have to be a doctor or a lawyer or an engineer or a disgrace to the family. Those are kind of like my four career paths in life. And so for him, it was always important that I would earn money with what I do. And I think that shaped me in many ways. When I went indie, part of my drive was to make money making this, because I wanted to prove to my father that I had a real job, right? That it was not just not the way my dad would tell me, like, yeah, Rami, you got to stop playing Nintendo. It's enough playing Nintendo. Like, you have to get a real job. You're gonna have a family. You want to buy a house. Like, you can't be playing Nintendo to get a house, right?
So that was
really important to me. Yeah, right. But that kindergarten teacher was probably the most important one, because when he realized, his name was Robert, and in the Netherlands, we refer to teachers in elementary school as meester or juffrouw. So he was Meester Robert to me. He, a very kind-hearted man, he realized that I was not annoying, but bored, or maybe both, but he realized I was bored. He basically started a chess program and a computer program as optional activities just to keep me entertained. And the chess program, the teacher we got for that, his name was Pete. And Pete, he didn't just teach us chess, he also taught us to make variations of chess. So set the board in not normal ways, or change the rules for how this piece moves. You know, like a rook moves like a knight, or everything on the back row moves like a queen, or make your own rules. Like if a piece goes over halfway of the board, they can move twice as far. And we would come up with all these different game rules and play chess with it. And I didn't realize that at the time, but that's game design.
It is.
Right. And the other program he started was a computer program. so I had more access to computers. And this one, because the hand-me-down we had at home was an MS-DOS computer. This one had Windows 3.11, which means you could play Worms on it, and you could play Ski Free on it, and you could play all these other games that I'd never seen before. And it was mind-blowing to me that there was this much more computer. So I think if I can point at anybody who like really triggered that creative spark, it was Mace at Oberyn. He recently retired, and I went to his retirement party because I heard about it. And I went there, and it was strange because the last time this man saw me, I must have been 6 years old. And I walked into the room he was at, and he looked at me, and he did this like squint. And when I got close to him, he just went, "Rami?"
Aww.
I'm like, "Yep." And he's like, "Did things work out with you?" And I just pulled up a few news articles and I showed it to him, and he looked at me and he was like, "Seems things work out with you, didn't they?" I'm like, "I like to think so." He's like, "I'm glad to hear that." So
wow.
It was there's a few people I would like to make proud in my life, and he's definitely one of them. So my parents being the others.
Oh,
so.
Of course. Your mom is now a gamer, as we've all seen. She does play
Mom versus games. Yep. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, she's now end of Ghost of Tsushima.
Oh.
She's in Act 3.
Yeah.
She says it's a bit much violence for her, but she really likes that you can slash open any door instead of like opening. She never opens the door anymore. Every door is just like slash. And even if she doesn't have to go through a door, she will not leave a door unharmed. All doors have to fall.
No door left behind. I like it. Yeah.
Yes.
Good. Yeah. Perfect. You know, when you're talking about making people proud and that creative spark, do you find that that is part of what drives you to be successful? Do you find it's that wanting to make people proud? Is it that validation? Or is there another secret driver that's got you going?
I think, so, you know, if you listen to my story, I tried to be a programmer.
Uh-huh.
And that's definitely not what I ended up being, right? I ended up being this person that sort of like acts as an ambassador to game development and somebody that travels around the world creating opportunity for game developers. And I think part of my success is obviously wanting to make people proud, right? Like part of why I chase that is trying to make people proud. But I think the other thing that I realized that very early on, when the indie scene, as we know it now, was young in 2010-ish, around when I started, business was not really a consideration. Making money was not really a consideration. It was mostly a bunch of kids, usually with a bit of money behind them, you know, not wealthy parents, but they had enough stability to mess around with stuff like this, making games, and they were students. They didn't need money. And because I was driven to prove to my dad that this was a real job, I was very serious about that. So Flambeer did really well for an indie studio because most of the competition wasn't that serious about business at the time. And we were serious about press. We were serious about the business model. It got to a point where at first all the indies sort of like a lot of the other indies didn't like me. They thought of me as a suit, mm-hmm. as somebody who was just there for the business. But I was working with JW, with Jan Willem, my co-founder, who was very well respected at the time. So people just kind of accepted me in. And eventually it got to the point where Flambeer was making enough money that a lot of people wanted, and this was a thing for a while, they wanted a Rami, right? Somebody to do the business and
just
all that.
Rolling out our own Ramis, just you get a Rami, you get a Rami, got it.
Exactly. The thing I realized is as we gain money and as we gain resources and as we gain success, it was actually easier to help other people, mm-hmm. right? And for me, that was sort of eye-opening, that being able to help people is partially dependent on having the resources and the reach and the influence to help people, to make a certain viewpoint heard, to be able to, I hate the word lobby, but really lobby for certain things, right? And since then, I've helped create part of like how PlayStation and Microsoft think about indie, right? And how they approach independent developers. And I've had long conversations with folks at Steam on like how to make things fairer and help sort of like shape policy and like how people think about things. I've standardized how press kits get made. And a lot of that is only possible because I have that reach, right? Because I am successful. And it's part of why I'm stuck on that infernal hellscape of Twitter. Because even though I love Twitter and I have a great time on it, it's definitely a draining place. But if I lose it, I immediately also lose a lot of my ability to project things that I think are important. And that for me includes making things fairer for hundreds of thousands of developers around the world that are doing things across a language barrier, right? That are doing things in places where the economy isn't that strong, or where the government doesn't support game development, or where nobody listens to them. I think part of me wants to be invisible frequently, where I just wish that people would stop paying attention to everything I do. And part of me knows that if that would happen, I would be unhappy because it feels like I've wasted an opportunity to help. Right.
Yeah.
So I think my primary driver now is I want to help. I want to be helpful. That's really it. I think I've realized over the past few years that if I have a life goal, it's that. So I just want to be useful and helpful and make game development better.
No one who knows you would ever accuse you of being anything but helpful. I do think you bring up an amazing point there. We often think of life lessons sometimes as trite. They've been prodded around too much, and you can't pour from an empty cup is something that my mom said a lot in life, because I very much like to run myself into the ground, and I know you do as well. We like to light our candles at both ends and the middle.
Right.
Would you sort of speak to that, and how do you replenish that candle? How do you find that when your cup is overflowing, how do you find that you figure out where to get that energy back?
Right. I mean, it's funny, right? Because I think part of why we do that, part of why we light the candle from as many places as possible is because we also realize that the state we're in, where we have this reach or where we have the ability to do this, might be limited, right? As long as we have this ability, we tend to use it as much as we can and as helpful as we can. And yeah, we do run ourselves into the ground doing that every now and then, which is unfortunate. But I understand why. For me, I think a lot of replenishing, the weird thing about it is that the work is really hard, but then the rewards are much bigger, it feels like. You know, if you can help somebody and you see that spark in their eyes, mm-hmm. and you see the happiness at like having achieved something that was previously thought impossible. Right? For me, it's seeing an independent developer that never thought that they would get their game funded to get their game funded, or to see their game reach these new heights in the press, or to see the first review of their game and it's a positive review. And I've helped them achieve that. That moment where you get that DM, where you get that message from somebody who's launching their first game, or they've bought something that they've always wanted with the success of their game, or the initial response is good, and you get that message. It's almost like an instant battery refill, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's a mental refill only. Like it's not a. I'm still tired, but I feel good, right?
Right.
The tiredness is harder, right? Like your ability to do things is a bit like a muscle. And if you overstretch it, the more you harm yourself that way, honestly, the harder it is to recover, right? Like you get tired and then you try to recover. And then the more tired you are, the harder it is to recover. And the more often you are tired, the harder it is to recover. And I've honestly found that the only way to recover from that is take time off. Like I have to take time off. And I'm pretty sure that if I spread things out more, right, I would need to take less time off. I just can't. Somebody reaches out and it's like, hey, can you help with this? I have to. I don't know. I feel like I have to because now I can. And what if between now and then, you know, the world changes and now nobody uses Twitter anymore, or the world changes and a lot of the people that I could use to help this person are no longer in that position and I have to rebuild those connections, or whatever happens in the next period of time. So I always feel like I can help now. Let's help now.
And I feel like there's something to that where people like yourself tend to hear cries for help and they are unable to turn away. It's, you know, that Marvel line of, I wish I could turn away from a situation pointed south, but I just can't. And you know, to me, that reads a lot in you.
Right. I mean, I think it's the same for you. Like from the conversations we've had in our life, like it's the same for you, right? It's the same thing where there is a problem and you know that you're uniquely positioned, or one of the few people positioned to actually do something here, right? To like properly understand what's happening and do something. And I think for you, very similarly, that spark of joy in somebody when they realize that they regained access, or they gained access to games, it's a spark. It's a spark. It's like it's electricity. It allows you to run more. But eventually there is the wall. There's always the wall, right? There's always the point where you can't give more. And the person who taught me, very similar to you at being your mom, for me, it was my grandma, who was like, she had 12 kids. And she told me, like, who do you think, which of the kids, because some of them were in university, some of them were in high school, some of them were in elementary school, and some weren't at school yet. And that's what happens when you have 12 kids. And she asked me, which of those do you think I made breakfast for first? And I tried every answer until she said, no, myself.
Oh, that's great. I was like,
why? Like, all the kids need food. She's like, if I collapse because I haven't eaten, then nobody gets food. I'm like, Yeah, that makes sense.
Oh.
I mean, that's very fair.
I love those moments where someone says something very just wise and in the moment, and then it just sticks with you for the rest of your life.
Yep. I think those are all the most important life lessons, aren't they?
Yeah.
They're just people saying something because you need to hear it in that moment. And then because of the moment, because of the context, because of the shock of you coming to the realization of that they're right, that's what sticks with you, I think.
Yeah. I know for me personally, you know, from a lot of our mutual friends, a lot of it is we all give out a lot of advice, particularly if we are on social media a lot, and a lot of it is filtered out in noise. But I do find that human psychology is a bit of a puzzle, and sometimes you're just sort of missing that one piece. So when you hear it, you hear that puzzle piece, you're like, oh my gosh, this fits right here where I had this void and I needed this little bridge to reach the other side, and now I've got it. And you hang on to it for dear life. You know, do you find that you have a lot of life moments like that where you heard something and you're like, wow, that is it right there?
I think my life has been, especially the last 10 years, it's been a lot of that because I've been traveling the world for a decade, right? And a lot of it happened because when I just started, I did a lot of public speaking, and it was so that I could afford to travel because they would pay for my travel, they would pay for my hotel, and that way I got to speak to international press. In the Netherlands, if you are successful, right, if you're a successful game developer, there isn't anywhere to go. There's no award shows. There's no 30 under 30. There's no game awards. There's none of that. It doesn't exist. The biggest thing we have is our press, which writes in Dutch, which means that about 15 million people in the world can read it. That's it, right? So for us with Vlaambeer, for me, one of the goals was to reach the English press. We wanted to reach London, but we couldn't afford it because we were school dropouts. So public speaking is what got us there. And then the public speaking got really popular because we were looking at things from a business perspective as well. And before I knew it, I was getting invites from like Uruguay and Indonesia and India and like all these other places that I had honestly never considered had game development at that point, right? And I asked them, can you afford to fly me out? And they're like, no, we're like seven people making games. Like, we don't have money.
It's like, right.
Well, I also can't afford that. So like, maybe in the future, hopefully. And then we released Ridiculous Fishing, which was our first hit game, and we made a lot of money. And I asked my co-founder if it was okay to spend some of that money on going to all of those places that had invited me. And the thing is, it's not so much that people told me things that stuck with me. People have told me many things that have stuck with me. But I think going to a new place and seeing how people do the thing that I do, but in a different context. Right.
Right.
That has been eye-opening to me. I was in an African country once where people would print out their code. They would print out the code. And I was like, why would you print out the code? They're like, well, sometimes electricity goes out for, you know, a week or two. So that way we can still do some work. And I'm like,
wow.
You are making video games knowing that at any point the power can go out for 2 weeks. They're like, yeah, we have some generators. Like we can, you know, work a little, but... And I was just shocked. And it gives you so much appreciation for, you know, the convenience that we have, but also admiration for the perseverance that they have, right? And every place I go, I would learn something new. Every country I would go to, every community I would meet, I would learn something new about the challenges people face, the opportunities people have, the amazing contexts in which they're making games. And for me, The other eye-opening thing was realizing that fingerprint of game development. This is a conversation that usually comes up, and the example I always use is war games, right? Is that a lot of video games are made from a US Western perspective, right? which means that when you have games about war, the American perspective on war tends to be, we fight a war to win the war, right? And it's never a war in the US. It's always a war on foreign soil. And the worst thing that can happen is somebody doesn't come home, which is awful.
Right.
So when US people make games about war, you make games about storming Normandy. You make games about going to a foreign country, fighting a war. And you make games about the worst thing that can happen is you can die. But then when the Germans made a game about war, they made a Spec Ops The Line, which is a game about the trauma of war and the guilt that comes with war, which for a German studio makes a lot of sense that the German attitude towards war, obviously having been the aggressor in the Second World War and a big part of World War I, their attitude towards war is very different. And when a Polish studio made a game about war, they made This War of Mine, which is a game about surviving war, because Poland doesn't fight wars. Wars get fought in Poland. So that fingerprint starts becoming really, really obvious. Dutch games are sort of like minimalist. They kind of are self-deprecating in a weird way. Yeah. And whether you look at like Killzone, which is sort of like pushing against what it is to be a game, or Vlambeer's games, or Hidden Folks, or any other Dutch game, that culture is in there. I'm half Dutch, half Egyptian. I didn't expect there to be so much Dutch in the video games I make, right, but there is. And it was only when somebody explained it to me that I realized. And then you start traveling and you start seeing it everywhere, right? This is more of, this is a game that could only be made in Iran. This is a game that only could be made in South Africa. This is a game that could only exist if it was made by people that grew up in a Brazilian culture. And it becomes so, games get so fascinating.
Yeah.
Right? When you start to see the fingerprints of individual people, you start to feel the fingerprints of the culture that's behind them. It makes me so happy.
Absolutely.
It makes me so happy about this medium.
It's a teaching medium. It gives us a different perspective on life. And I think one of the primary principles of gaming for me has been, you can look at it on a very surface level, and you can look at it on a very, here is objective, you must complete this in order to win the game. Ta-da, you did it. But in most cases, there are those themes running through the game that are actually a piece of the developer and putting right. themselves into that game. Have you found that perspective, that knowledge that there's a little bit of us in all of our creations, has that helped you feel your life outside of just coding a game?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, and it's absurd how far it goes, because one of the things I realized is there's this game called Farsh, which that was, if you're talking about life lessons, that was a life lesson for me. It's made by an Iranian developer, Mahdi Bahrami. He's about to release his new game. He's a very good puzzle designer. And he made this game about carpets. It's this carpet, and you roll it out, and you can roll it back up. And when you roll it out, it lays over certain tiles. And when you rotate it, it rotates all the tiles under it. Oh. And then you can roll your carpet up. It's a mechanic I had never seen before.
Okay.
Literally in my entire life, never seen before. And, you know, if you spend long enough in games, you kind of start to see, okay, this mechanic is a variation on that mechanic. This mechanic is copied from here, but then adjusted that way, or the context has changed. And you you get this feeling of like, okay, they're doing this with that. They're doing, and this, I was just looking at it, I'm like, I have never seen this before. Right? Never.
Amazing.
And I went to Mahdi and I asked him, how did you come up with this mechanic? Like, this is brand new. How did this happen? He's like, well, I roll carpets sometimes. And he's like, what? That's it? He's like, yeah. And I started to realize that in our Western culture, the sort of expanding, retracting thing, we got stuck with snake. That's just kind of what happened. Uh-huh. We agreed that things can grow and shrink, and that's kind of it. And that mechanic sort of like took that direction and went that way. Right. So right at the start, we sort of like blocked off a part of the mechanical thinking space. And because everybody has played Snake, for everybody, that's sort of like a base of where we move. But this rolling carpet and rolling back up the carpet, that's a completely new method of movement, of mobility. And the only way somebody would have come up with that, apparently, is if they weren't restricted by the sort of Western attitudes towards it, but also had something to inspire a different attitude towards it. And that part of why I travel the world trying to make sure that people can develop games and that they have the same opportunities as developers elsewhere is that I believe there's so many mechanics out there still. So many new things, like games we've never played before, right? Mechanics that we look at and we're like, That's mind-blowing. What is that? And then my hope is, as always, when indies come up with new stuff, AAA kind of steals the best of it, right?
Yeah.
And then indie is partially inspired by AAA, partially because we want to emulate them and partially because we want to rebel against them. You know, AAA is doing this, indies want to do the other thing, right? AAA is very narrative, indies want to be mechanics first. AAA starts being very mechanics first, indie wants to do narrative. And there's always this push and pull between the two. So AAA steals from indie and indie is inspired by AAA. And that if everything works perfectly, that loop is this beautiful continuous wheel of cool stuff happening. Yeah, that makes me want to add, like, what happens when you put some Iranian influence into that, right?
Yeah,
just a new mechanic. What happens now? Any country, any people. So, for me, it's impossible to look at games without that. And I think part of that is the curse of being a game developer, right? Yeah. You start to know the people. And I'm sure you kind of have the same thing where you start to know the people making games and you start to recognize the person in the work.
Absolutely. Right?
You start to see, oh, this is definitely a game made by this person, or this is definitely a game inspired by this school of thinking, or it's a really different way of looking at games now that I'm a game developer. There's always this discussion about, in my mind, about whether I'm still a gamer, whether that is still true for me, because I've seen so much behind the curtain, and that's so much my method of thinking that for me playing a game, a large part of it is like dismantling what it is and how it works and why it works and, you know, what priorities they have. And my friends don't want to play Halo with me anymore. It's really sad.
Oh, no.
Because I would go and, like, they would run and go and want to beat the bosses. And I just can't stop myself from being like, wait. I want to see. Is this billboarded?
Oh, no.
Give me one second. Can you hit me with the hammer once? Yeah, I just want to see what the damage is. Like, now take a step. Oh, I'm dead. Yeah, give me 5 seconds. I'll respawn. Can you hit me from 2 feet further? And it's like, can we just play the game? I'm like, yeah. Just hit me first. So I'm excited to see if when Infinite comes out, whether I actually have friends to play it with.
No, that makes sense. It almost sounds like a baker, bringing these creations to life by adding these different ingredients. You know, a little bit of yourself is the creation of the process, but you need the mechanics in there. And, I always feel like in creative mediums, when we're talking to creators who have been doing this for a while, particularly people who would consider themselves successful, there's always this school of thought. Either it's, there's nothing new under the sun, so just do it your way. Or there's the, I know there's undiscovered country out there. I just have to find it. Where do you find yourself on that spectrum? Are you looking for that undiscovered country, or are you just trying to figure out where the flavor text is in everything that's already been made?
I think it's a bit of both. I believe there is infinite potential still out there. Games are young, right? They're so incredibly young, and you only have to look at some of the developments lately to know that games are young. Like when Stadia was coming up, right? And they had sort of like promised this integration with YouTube, and I just sat down and just like, hundreds of games ideas just appeared out of nowhere. Just things that you could do, right? Like, I had this one idea. What if you make a roguelike that's tied to your YouTube account and you can play it once? And then anybody who watches the video of you playing can stop the video and then continue playing from that point.
Oh, wow.
And then everybody on Earth can do that, but you can only continue one time from one run.
Wow.
So you would have the early explorers, the people that are like, no, I wanna just see how far I get. You'd have the people that would strategically wait and watch all these different people play it and then go like, no, I wanna continue that run. And you would only get to play it once. And then hopefully, as a species, we would eventually achieve the ending, or somebody would achieve the ending. And it was a game idea that I don't think could have existed before, right? Because you would need that specific integration that they promised with watching a stream and then picking up or like playing together with the people playing it. That could only work that way. So every time there's sort of a technological breakthrough, there's all this new opportunity. But even without the technical breakthrough, around the world, there's all this cultural opportunity and all these mechanics like Mahdi's that don't exist yet because they haven't had the chance to grow, or they haven't had the space to grow. So I believe there's infinite space left in games. And you look at like the big moments in games, like the Minecrafts, the Battle Royales, all of that, that's new. And now we're seeing the refinement. Now they're refining those mechanics, but they also open up our minds to new ways of playing. I feel there will always be more space for new things. So both nothing new under the sun in that there's always new stuff to find, right?
Yeah.
That's, yeah. It's exciting.
Do you find that's part of, you know, the Habibis, you know, is sort of why you went that way and you decided, you know, what was it, like, games are great, but also I want to do this other thing too.
Yeah, I think so. For me, one of the challenges of the past few years has been in 2018, the Game Developers Choice Award, which is sort of like one of the biggest awards in games, gave me this Ambassador Award, which was an award for representing the medium of games in a positive way. And it kind of threw my life off balance in a weird way, because you get this award and now you're kind of like, okay, I've done the thing.
I did it. Woo!
Do I retire now? Like, what happens?
Yeah.
It feels like it's not an award for somebody my age. It feels like the award for somebody that's like, you know, 60 and has spent their entire life advocating for games. They have a lifetime achievement award for that. So, you know,
yeah.
I guess the Ambassador Award makes sense. But part of me is also realizing that my reach has maybe gotten too big to be helpful, which is a weird contradiction where...
Yeah.
Now, everything I want to do, people expect it to be helpful to everybody.
Right.
And it can't be.
I feel that, right? Yeah.
It can't be.
Yeah.
The more reach you have, the more people want you to represent everything correctly. And I realized that it was stopping me from being helpful to some of the things that I find are most important. And one of those is Arab representation, because in games, most of how we were represented is ragdolls, right? Like, blow them up. Shoot them, like, whatever. So for me, it was really important to make a positive space for Arabs and for people that are interested in Arab culture and for people that are interested potentially in Islam or in how other religions or ideologies exist in the Arab world. And automatically sort of like grabs part of like South Asia, which also is like very close to Arab culture or related to Arab culture in parts of North Africa, and just create a space that is nice.
Yeah.
You know? So there's a number of notable Arab game developers and game designers, and one of them, Osama Dorias, is a very dear friend of mine.
Love him.
And yeah, Osama is great. And we were playing Captain Tsubasa Rise of New Champions, which is this anime soccer game. Because in the Arab world, it was actually dubbed Captain Majid. So growing up, I'd watched that anime series. And I thought it was an Egyptian series. I was like, why is there a Japanese version of this? But it turns out it was a Japanese series that was dubbed into Arabic.
Wow.
Should have known, because all the flags were Japanese. But six-year-old me wasn't paying attention to that.
We'll forgive you for that one. It's okay.
Right. So we were playing that game, and we were just having a great time. And I played it with Fawzi Mesma as well, who's another Arab game developer. And we just had such a good time chatting that we said, well, why don't we make a space then where we can chat about video games, and then hopefully other people will come too. So that's how the Habibis podcast started. And it's been such a blast. The community is small but growing, and... It's currently, as we're recording this, it's Ramadan, so it's like this big cultural event in the Arab world where, you know, the you would call it the Christmas lights, but the Christmas lights are out, and like everybody is celebrating and, you know, fasting, and or if they're not Muslim, not fasting, and these big meals happen in the street, and like everybody has like family visits and stuff like that. So it's this joyful time, and to have a space for that in games is really lovely. So. It's been good. It's been nice. It's nice to do something focused as well, where you're like, okay, this isn't for everybody. This is for this group of people. Right. I want to help this group of people right now, which is nice.
I think you kind of touched on something that a lot of people can identify with, which is they want that aircraft carrier banner being thrown down. Mission accomplished. We did it. Thumbs up, you know, the helmet underneath the armpit and thumbs up to the camera. You know, but also there's something great about starting something new that is focused on something else that maybe doesn't have a necessarily end point. It has a purpose, you know, for being. You know, what do you think it is that you have learned in your many lifetimes now of, you know, having these accolades and having it be the journey and not the end point?
That's a very good question. I think the thing that I've come to appreciate about trying to achieve things is that there's this feeling that when you achieve a goal, that you're going to be happy and fulfilled and that you're done. I don't think that's necessarily how life works. Life is this moving goalpost, right? Every time you achieve something, there's something more to achieve. For a while, I lost myself in that, where I was never happy about any of my achievements, right? Because everything was coming so fast. Like for Vlambeer, for the first few years, 3 hit games in a row, Ridiculous Fishing, suddenly we had money. Luftrausser is one of the first indie games to come to go onto PlayStation. Nuclear Throne, we were the first game to ever sell a copy on Twitch. Wow. It was a hack. It was a disaster. The subscribe button, you have a Twitch API and you have a Steam API. And I just said, okay, what if we attach the subscribe button in the Twitch API to a Steam code from the Steam API? And then when that worked, I just tweeted, you can now buy Nuclear Throne on Twitch. And then for the next 6 hours, I was fielding press questions from, like, is Twitch selling games? We're like, no, we're selling games. And then I got an email from, I forget who it was, but at Twitch, somebody emailed me as like, are you telling people you're selling games on Twitch? We're like, yeah, here, try. They're like, okay, but we need to work on the wording for that. Because we're not selling games. You're doing some weird stuff to make this work. A few months later, they called me and they're like, so you're selling game on Twitch, right? I'm like, yeah. They're like, okay, we're considering also selling games on Twitch. You should tell us about how it works.
Someone's super panicked. They're like, oh no, how did he get our idea? No.
Right. So then Twitch started selling games as well. And that only lasted for a little bit, because it turns out that unless you're doing it the way we were doing it, where people are watching the development and like very closely connected to what is happening, people kind of don't want to buy games on Twitch. That's not where they want to do that. But every time I'd achieve something, I'd be like, okay, now what's next? Now what's next? Now what's next? Right. And I think it wasn't until we shut down Vlambeer last year that I had time to like reflect and properly look at what had happened. I'm pretty proud of everything that's happened. Like a lot has happened and I'm grateful for all the opportunity. And I think that, you know, given the information I had at any given point and given the opportunity I had, like everything went incredibly well. Like I have nothing to complain about. But I've started to learn that the goal, if you're doing something for the goal, it's always going to be hard. Because the goal, when you get there, is never going to be as satisfying as you think. Like, it's the journey of moving that goal upwards and achieving those goals in between, for me, that really speaks to me. And that makes me happy. It's the growth of what you think you can do and then getting slightly above that every single time, where eventually where you are is beyond the wildest dreams you could have had, like, a year ago. Or 2 years ago, right? Where you're looking at things, you're like, can you believe what my life is? I mean, you must have a similar feeling, right?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
You look at where life is now and you compare it to, you know, PAX, what, 2 or 3 years ago. You see what Able Gamers have achieved. You see what you have achieved. You see what industry-wide has happened with the representation of accessibility and the visibility for these issues. And it's almost impossible to believe the leap that has happened, right?
Right.
And lots of people pushing, lots of people fighting, but there was this perfect storm of things that got together that pushed at the same time, that made this herd that talked about this at the same time. And if you would have told either of us 3 years ago, 5 years ago, what our life would be right now, I don't think. No. Would you have believed it?
No, definitely not. No. I mean, and that's, for me, has always been the weird thing now. You know, people, I'm sure, same for you, will come to you and be like, what's it like to get awards and you know all these cool people and, you know, this just happened to you overnight? It's like, well, it happened to me over 15 years of nights. But yeah, pretty much.
Right.
You know, you know, you're up there on the stage and you're like, this is amazing. And I talked about this in a YouTube video where, you know, I'm on the stage, I'm getting the accolades, I'm getting given the award. You know, I've driven across the freaking country in order to get it, which is a humongous Herculean task for me since I can't fly. You know, and then you feel great and then you get it and then you're like, huh, all right. now what do I do? Okay.
Yes, exactly. I think in most cases in life, you don't have this moment of reconfiguration where you're moving towards something and then, you know, you always kind of move to the next thing. And these big moments in life where everybody sort of acknowledges something that you've done or talks about something that you've done, or these big initiatives that you launch, or in the case of game developers, these games that you launch, suddenly this thing you've been working towards has been completed.
Yeah, right?
It's like clearing the main quest of a video game, right? And now you're in like the open world thing and you're kind of looking at it and you're like, shall I get feathers?
Right. Save three.
I guess there's 70. Right. There's 74 feathers left. Shall I go grab these feathers? I think most normal lives, you have a number of those moments, right? Like when people move into a new house, or when they end or start a big relationship, or when somebody passes, or when somebody is born, you have these moments of reconfiguration in your life. And I think those big moments where these pedestals come out, they're kind of weird. I don't think people are meant to have too many of those moments in life. I don't think that's how it's supposed to be. So I think for a lot of people, that's really hard. It's a really hard thing. And I see it in game developers. Like, a lot of game developers have this period of like post-release depression.
Yeah.
Where the game is out and you think they'd be really happy, but really they've just lost their purpose.
Yes.
Right? They've just lost what they're trying to do. They've been so close to this game and it's been so important to them and it's been looming over them as this amazing privilege to be working on it, but also this amazing burden of wanting to make sure it's good and not disappointing anybody. And now it's out. And here comes the, hey, you know what? It gets an 8. It's an 8. It's good. It's a pretty good game.
Yeah.
Well done.
Yeah.
And you're just like, good.
Good, yeah.
Okay. Now what?
Yeah.
Who am I? Can anybody introduce me to me? Because I don't know anymore. I think that those moments, they're very powerful. They really allow you to sort of take a look at your life and see what the direction is and sort of like figure out whether you're happy with what you're doing. But they also put so much pressure to continue the momentum you're in. Like you can't get that award and go like, you know what? I am done.
Yeah.
It was great. I'm out. Part of it grows in responsibility. It grows in privilege. It grows in opportunity. It grows in your ability to help. But those are very strange, abstract questions that I don't think the human mind is particularly good at
dealing with. I don't think so.
So it's been strange. It's been fun. It's been this really weird roller coaster of I never know what happened, right? I'm just sitting at the place I'm in right now, and it has made me appreciate the journey more than the goal, because I know that whenever I reach the goal, something is going to happen. I'm going to be sitting there going, so am I going to collect the other 74 feathers, or am I good? So
yeah,
you just kind of keep going. And as long as that keep going is helpful to people, I'll keep going.
That's
as long as I can.
That's admirable. And I think one of the purposes of this new show was to highlight those of us who are kind of caught in what people perceive as the middle of the success ladder, because You're a name in the industry. If you're watching this and you're a video gamer, you know who Rami is. You probably know who Steve is. But if you're not in the video games industry, you might not know who either one of us are, because we're in the video game space. And now that can be said for every industry, of course. Every industry has their own stars and whatnot. But, you know, I have, just like you do, friends who have a million followers on Twitter, 10 million on Instagram, and I have friends that have 3 followers or don't have a Twitter. And
right.
I think we have this unique perspective of seeing both sides of the coin. And I don't know that everyone feels like they do, although I would argue that they do, because everyone has people who are less successful in this area, more successful in that. It all depends on which way you push yourself. You know, for you, right, you know, focusing, you know, how did you decide that you wanted to focus on one specific area of your life and sort of push that way?
I think for me, it always happened by accident, right? Like, dropping out of school was not something I was planning to do. It was just school wasn't interesting to me anymore. And there was one other person dropping out, and it was one of the people I hated most in that school. But He was the one that was also dropping out, and his skills complemented mine. So we just decided to do one game together. And then that game was successful. So then we did another game together. And then it was 10 years later. And, you know, I started doing public speaking because I needed to do public speaking. And then people appreciated my public speaking. So I kept doing public speaking. And then I had the money to start traveling to all these other places to do public speaking. And it sort of became my thing. And I think for me, It's really interesting because fame exists in very strange shapes. And I think that the thing I really adore about how my fame exists or my visibility exists is I think it's mostly in industry, right? In the industry, people have heard of me generally. Like whether they like me or not is a very different question.
But I feel that
they've heard of me,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Outside of the industry, it's a specific crowd that knows me, right? It's the people that are design curious, that really like game design. It's people that like arcade games, people that like independent games, and people that are interested enough in the industry that they've kind of like explored what that industry looks like. And it makes me very industry facing. If I go to PAX and I go around the show floor, I get stopped every... It was really funny. I was with a very famous Twitch streamer. I was walking across the show floor, and we would get stopped every 5 feet. And it was always the developer from a booth talking to me, and then somebody that was playing the game in the booth talking to the Twitch streamer.
That makes sense, yes.
And it makes total sense, but it makes me really happy because, like I said, for me, the point of all this is that I can reach developers and help developers. So if the developers are the one that recognize me, that's cool. And if it's aspiring developers, you know, kids that want to make games, people that are thinking about going into games, I want to be there for those people. And if nobody else recognizes me, I'm okay with that. I'm very okay with that. But as long as it makes it easier for me to help people, then I would like to be recognized more. Because if that helps, then great, let's go. But it is strange, yeah. I mean, my work's obviously so incredibly focused on people that have no opportunity at the moment or that have very limited reach in the industry at the moment that for me, a lot of my thinking and a lot of what I'm doing is based around, okay, what do you do when you have 12 followers on Twitter?
Right.
Right. How can you fix that? How can you fix it if you have no contacts in the industry? How can you get your first introduction to Microsoft or Sony or Apple or Android or, you know, whoever, to a publisher, to a Devolver or a Raw Fury or a 505 or whatever? Like, how do you deal with that inequality of somebody in Malawi not having access to any of those resources while somebody who grew up in the US, even though they might not have maximum access to those resources, they're still going to be ahead of the person in Malawi, right? So how do you make that fair? So for me, I always feel enormous compared to a lot of the people that I work with in terms of reach. And then the people that have more reach than me, they tend to be people that help out, right? That support or also believe in my mission and help support it. So there's this weird thing where I think being in the middle of the ladder is probably a really nice place to be.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. Yeah. Do you have words of advice for those people that are trying to climb the ladder and, you know, they just see it as this giant ice wall of Game of Thrones style that could never be conquered, you know?
I think the thing is, part of it is you can't fully control it. There's you're just going to have to start climbing and hope that the ice wall, the part of the ice wall where you're climbing actually goes up. It's like a very unfair roguelike.
Yeah.
Like that's kind of what it is. You go down a path and you don't know if that path actually goes anywhere, and you won't find out until you're halfway up the wall. The two things that I found that are really important is be a kind person to people that are at the same place as you. Mm-hmm. A lot of people think of climbing the ladder as something that requires you to step on the other people on the ladder with you. And it's usually not in working with people that are bigger than you. It's in working with people that are lateral to you,
right?
People that are at the same height of the ladder. You know, like rising tide lifts all ships.
Yes.
That kind of idea. Being a kind person to the people that are in the same space as you or not even at the same space as you is always going to be a better way than trying to like step on them on your way up, because they will eventually catch up and they will kick you off the ladder for being a terrible person. and they will be right,
yes.
Right? The other thing that I've learned from seeing other people do this, I got really fortunate in that the thing that I'm known for is the thing that I'm passionate about. And one of the things I've realized is that the difference in mental health and happiness between people that reach a certain level of visibility or fame is that the people that are being genuine and that actually care about the things that they're known for, that they're much happier than the people that ended up doing something because they wanted to be successful.
Yes.
Like, I think this... The story that you refer to at the start, that nobody thought that this could be a job, but they did it anyway, it means that they cared, right? They cared about this because they wanted to do this, and this is their natural state. This is what they would do, even if it wasn't successful. If they had the resources to do anything, this is what they would be doing. And if you try to do things that aren't natural to do, that aren't sincere, that aren't genuine, then when you get to the part where you have to put up more walls and you have to be more careful with what you do and you have to be more intentional about what you do, it's going to get so much harder. Because if you're already not coming from a sincere place or a genuine place, just doing the work is exhausting for that reason. And the work is exhausting. So that's like double exhausting. It made me feel really sad for people that get visible for reasons that they aren't actually excited about, because that sounds heartbreaking. It's hard enough when you care.
Yeah.
Really, really is.
Yeah.
So yeah, be kind, help people, and do stuff you care about. And if that works out to be successful, take that opportunity and run with it. If it turns out to not be successful, hopefully you're already doing something you love. And even though it doesn't work out perfectly, you know, it doesn't work out exactly the way you want, it's better than the alternative of it kind of working out the wrong way.
Right. You know, if you have a purpose in life that is to be a better person and to help others, to have empathy and kindness, and that's your purpose, then that is an unending goal and it will always drive you. If you have a purpose of, I want to publish a game, then as soon as it's done, then you're going to find yourself just withering on the vine. And, okay, you know, I find that's one of the life lessons that I took from you and our friendship along the way, was that you are constantly striving for that next person to help. Like, there's never a time where I have known you and you are literally like just sitting around looking at the ceiling going, what do I do now? You're always just like, well, I got 9 other people to help and enough energy to help 4 of them, so let's figure this out.
Let's see if I can maybe mix 2 of them into 1 meeting so I can help 2 of them at once, and then I can help 5.
Always have to maximize that time.
Right. Yeah.
You know,
I think that's very true. That's very well said. It's, if your goal is to release a game, it's not going to work out. Your goal has to be to make games, plural, right? Like, because that can continue forever. You can keep making games. And if there's a purpose behind them, it'll be easier for you because you'll know where you're going. Yeah, that's very true.
Gotta stay away from that burnout while also, you know, helping. Yeah, it's a hard, delicate balance.
Yep. It's also hard because one of the things, obviously, that's very important in the industry now is showing people that you can do things without burning out and without, like, pushing yourself to the absolute limit. So I've been trying to be very aware of how I spend my time and where I spend my time. And my schedule is actually pretty transparent right now. You can look in my calendar and see what hours I'm booked and what hours I'm not to make meetings. So I'm trying to prove that a bit more as well. Like, you can do this in a healthy work-life balance. It's a challenge, but, you know, it's worth trying.
It's doable. You know, I can't even believe we've been talking for more than an hour now. And unfortunately, the YouTube algorithms demand that we keep these near an hour. So I have to wrap with you this time. You know, and I have to say, like, what an amazing pleasure. But I'm not done with you just yet. Are you ready for your final questions?
Okay, let's try and keep them short then.
They're going to be huge. They're going to be long-winded. These are 10 questions. They're going to come at you rapid-fire. I'm not going to interject any of my own thoughts or taste in this. This is all on you. They ramp up from very not serious to very serious. You're allowed to take as long as you want for each question, and then we'll be done. Ready?
Okay, let's go.
All right, favorite color?
Blue.
Least favorite color?
Red.
The best thing you've ever tasted?
It's a it's an Italian anchovy based tomato sauce. Yeah, it's a really strange one, but I had that and I don't like anchovy, and I just went, this is the best thing I've ever tasted.
What's the worst thing you've ever tasted?
This was in China. They gave me something called a century egg, which is an egg that is buried underground until it ferments, but because it's underground and it can't reach air, it can't rot. So it's basically a deeply fermented egg. It is apparently a local delicacy, but my stomach was really not. I've never had it. And, you know, when sometimes when you eat foods that are foreign to you, your body reacts very poorly. I think my body reacted maximum poorly to that one.
All right. Have you ever loved?
Yes.
Have you ever hurt somebody?
Yes.
What can somebody do to earn your trust?
I think I'm one of those people that very stubbornly believes everybody deserves my trust from the start. And it's not like maximum trust, but I trust that everybody is a good person when I meet them. And you can't earn my trust, you can mostly lose it.
What can somebody do to lose your trust?
Honestly, to be unfair, unkind, or untruthful. Any of those will do it.
If someone spoke to you the way that you speak to yourself when no one else is around, would you be friends with that person?
Yes, I think those are the only people I would be friends with. Because it's this weird thing where when I started in games, obviously, a lot of the people I met were, you know, I was nobody and they were nobody. And when you get to that point where people think very highly of you, friends get kind of complicated in that you want people that are your friends, not people that are friends with the version of you they imagine exists. Mm-hmm. Right? There's like Rami from Vlambeer, or, you know, Rami, the games industry ambassador. And then there's just me, just Rami. And I find that the people that will speak to me like I would speak to me are the people I tend to end up friends with.
If you died tomorrow, what do you hope the people would remember you for?
Hope that people think I was helpful. That I tried, right? That I always tried to be helpful. I don't really care too much about beyond that. I already feel like I've had a few pretty close calls with death. And if I look at life right now, I've had a very fortunate life. So if people just think I was helpful, then it's good.
The big question, do you have a personal life philosophy that you would attribute to getting where you are today?
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, my life philosophy, I think my life philosophy comes down to the biggest kindness you can do to the world is to make things fair, right? To make things that are unfair, fair. There's no greater kindness than that. So that's been my mission, that if things are unfair, I want to make them fair. And that's what I've been trying to do. That's what I am doing. And that's what I will continue to do. So, you know, we'll see at the end of everything. We'll see if I was right about that one. But it feels pretty correct so far.
Do you believe that some things are better left unsaid?
Yes. And I answered this because yesterday I was playing Nier Replicant and I had the choice between telling somebody had died or lying to them and they were dying. And I was like, yeah, no, they don't need this hurt in their life. Or was it Outriders? It might have been Outriders. Anyway, yeah, some things are better left unsaid. I feel it's unfair to take the decision away from the person that would receive the information, but tough. There's no right choices. There are only the choices you make in a case like this, and you'll have to live with the consequences, good or bad.
Rami Ishmael, the king of the indies, thank you so much for coming on and for being a mentor to all the people listening out there today.
It is my absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.